And of course, our special guest tonight, our investigative reporter, Linda Moulton-Howe, EarthFiles.com. Linda's got lots of material to cover, so we're going to get right into it with her when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And as I mentioned, Linda Moulton-Howe with us. She's got a lot of ground to cover, especially on this boom-sounding story. So let's go right to Linda. Hey, Linda, take it away.
Now, George, who would have thought after last month's report that the bizarre and still unexplained metallic jolting booms persist into April, including five new geographic locations, all happening within 3 days. First, a loud bang over five English counties provoked calls to emergency services at 6:10 p.m. local time on Friday evening, April 12th. After first saying it was investigating what the sound could be, later the Ministry of Defense said the bang was a sonic boom from two Typhoon jets launched to investigate an unusual emergency signal coming from a small helicopter hovering over Bath in Somerset County. But Earth Files has received information from an English mother whose adult son with good eyesight watched a silver disc above the small helicopter in Bath. And the UK's Sun newspaper also published a photograph of what is called a stocking-shaped UFO, meaning on your foot, stocking, photographed at the time of the boom. You can see this photograph at my news website, earthfiles.com, right now in this report. One witness said, quote, that two Typhoon jets did show up and kept circling the stocking-shaped UFO. It was very strange, close quote. Then 6 hours later, across the Atlantic, throughout central Ohio, a very loud boom was heard on Thursday night near 6 p.m. Central, also on April 12th. So this is in a timeline after England. The Ohio National Guard, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and the Federal Aviation Administration had no answers for what happened in central Ohio. And then going west that same Thursday night at 9 p.m. Pacific in Lacey, Washington, about 30 miles southeast of Tacoma, loud periodic metallic booms were heard until 3 a.m. on April 13th. So we're in that timeline from England to central Ohio to Lacey, Washington. Okay. After that, 6 hours after the last boom in Lacey, Washington, people all over San Diego County at 8:45 a.m. Pacific heard a huge boom all over the county. And then the next night on Saturday, April 14th at 7:30 p.m. Central in Columbia, Missouri, a university professor emailed me that he, his wife, and neighbors were alarmed by a sound he compared to a large metal railroad car that slammed full speed into a stone wall. In Bath, England, could the helicopter pilot have deliberately set off the emergency alarm, afraid of the UFO's intent, especially if the silver disc changed to the ionized stocking-shaped object? What really happened over Bath, England, on April 12th, the same date that the large metallic booms were heard on the other side of the world, over central Ohio, and then in Lacey, Washington, extending down to San Diego, and finally in Columbia, Missouri? In all four American cases, there were no military confirmations of aircraft breaking any sound barriers and no USGS evidence of local seismic events. I put together a montage of American witness reports beginning with the husband and wife in Lacey, Washington. And for the record, I checked with Lewis McChord Air Force Base about 15 miles north of Lacey. The Joint Base's spokesperson told me, quote, on April 9th, 2012, we issued an advisory for April 10th that 155-millimeter howitzers would be firing from 12:30 a.m. on the 10th until noon. That was for artillery firing 2 days before the 9 p.m. April 12th strange metallic booms began. John Ellison is 34 years old and a physical fitness trainer who has lived in Lacey since 2009, and he's heard artillery booms many times, and nothing was like what he heard on the 12th. And his wife, Kristen, is the manager of a local pharmacy. She said the same thing, nothing like she'd ever heard. John begins with the metallic boom sound that started the evening of Thursday, April 12th.
Around 9 p.m., my wife went up to bed, and I was downstairs watching TV, and that's when we heard this first strange noise. It was a loud boom. It was like a loud boom followed by a rumble that lasted between 2 to 4 seconds. So loud, she got up and came downstairs and said, "What was that? Did you hear it?" We had no idea what it could be, so she went back up to bed and laid down, and it must have been another 10 minutes later before we heard another one. And that shook the house a little bit. Went outside, looked, thinking, didn't sound like thunder at all. Had no sound quality of thunder. The sound it most resembled was, we used to live near some train tracks, and at night they would connect the cars up. And that would sound like a large boom as those cars connected, and then it would rumble down the tracks. And that is the closest thing it sounded like to me. That's what I first thought of when I heard it.
You're thinking of that because it had a metallic quality.
Yeah, it seemed like a metallic, especially in the rumbling aspect of it. It wasn't like a thunder rumble, it was more metallic.
In some other parts of the country, there have been descriptions like two trains colliding with a metallic rumbling sound.
Yeah, that is right on par with what we heard. And it was sporadic. There was no rhyme or reason. It wasn't like every 10 minutes you'd hear it. The intensity and volume of the sound would change. And the frequency. So the frequency and volume of it was stronger at the beginning, and it continued on sporadically, would happen between every 5 and 15 minutes.
Every 5 to 15 minutes?
Yeah, you'd hear another one. Wouldn't be the same intensity possibly as the one before it, but it continued on until I fell asleep around 3 in the morning, and it was still making those sounds.
That's 6 hours.
Yes.
Now, what is your nearest military installation?
That would be the Lewis McChord Joint Air Force and Army Base. That is directly between us and Tacoma. We're about 30 miles from Tacoma. It's a large base, and I thought this sound, possibly artillery. It wasn't a sonic boom, and I've heard artillery before, and it just didn't resemble that sound. You could kind of feel it reverberate like a really intense sound wave. I've just never heard anything like it before, you know. This doesn't make any sense.
Where you live, are there a lot of people around you in houses?
Oh, yeah. Lots of houses, very densely populated.
Now, why do you think you didn't call the police?
It was such a, I don't know. I guess in my mind it was like, there's just got to be a reasonable explanation. And my thought went right to the military base, even though it's such a strange sound.
John Ellison's wife, Kristen, compared the repeating loud metallic bangs to something heavy thrown into a metal dumpster.
First, it sounded like it was really close. How it sounded was like, you know, when you have one of those large metal dumpsters.
Right.
And as if you were throwing a very heavy, very dense object in it, and how it would just bang and make the vibration noise on the side as soon as it hit. Sometimes it was really close by, and then sometimes it seemed like it was further away.
How many times did you hear this metallic boom?
I heard it till I fell asleep around 10, 10:30. It was several times in that hour and a half that I was awake.
Did you go to any of your neighbors and ask if they heard these strange repeating metallic sounds?
I had not myself, no. I had spoken to a few friends who don't live in our direct area when we were out the next night talking. Hey, did you guys hear those booms? And one of the friends said, yeah, I heard it. I'm like, well, it's kind of unique in itself to hear the boom and slight vibration occur after it.
And so the idea of something breaking the sound barrier or artillery wouldn't make sense to you because you've never heard anything like this before.
Exactly, because I've heard, you can tell when they're breaking the sound barrier. Like, I've heard it before, and I've heard when they shoot the cannons off, and it is definitely different.
This was definitely different.
Yeah.
John Ellison remembers that the last metallic banging sound that he heard before he went to sleep was 3 a.m. What he and his wife, Chris, did not know is that about 6 hours later at 8:45 a.m., all of San Diego County, California, was jolted by a huge and unexplained boom sound. San Diego's Channel 10 News meteorologist Craig Herrera first thought it was an earthquake, but the U.S. Geological Survey has no record of a seismic event in San Diego County on Friday morning, April 13th.
It was just before 8:45, about 8:43, and I remember because I was lying in my bed and I was playing with my dogs, and all of a sudden I heard a loud thump, like somebody was banging on the wall outside, and the windows started rattling and shaking. It lasted about 3 to 4 seconds. I thought it was going to be an earthquake. I was waiting for the rumble of the ground to start rolling, but it never happened. The dogs jumped up and started running around the house, barking and going to each window, trying to see if someone was at the window.
That thump, when you said it sounded like somebody hit the wall outside, it was just one singular jolt?
One singular jolt.
And then, was there any vibration, like in your bed or the floor?
It happened so fast, I jumped up and got out of the bed because the windows were rattling about 3 or 4 seconds. And I went to grab the dogs, and then all of a sudden it stopped. No more shaking, no more rattling, no more loud noise.
And from a meteorologist's point of view, what was your reaction?
I honestly thought it was an earthquake. I didn't think it was anything to do with the storm that was moving in. It was still in Los Angeles. We didn't get it to about 4:30 in the afternoon. So I knew that it wasn't thunder. I knew it wasn't lightning. I don't think that I've ever seen or felt that kind of vibration with any kind of thunderstorm.
Was this extremely puzzling to you that it was just one thumping jolt?
It was. I just figured it was some little tremor.
But the USGS confirmed later that there was no seismic event.
Correct.
What about military?
We spoke with some military spokesperson from Miramar who informed us that there was nothing that they knew of that would have caused the boom.
With that information, what did you think?
I was still puzzled. I had no idea what to think. I didn't know what could cause it, especially since there were other reports around the county.
Right. I understand this was across San Diego County. That's a lot of geography and people.
Absolutely. And not only in lower lying areas, but into the mountains and different areas of the county. I mean, the topography and the geography here, it varies. So it was felt throughout various places.
And in your discussions now with other professionals and people in the media, what is the current speculation about what might have happened?
No one knows. It's still one of those questions where people are still wondering what it was. It's just puzzling. No one really seems to know what happened. We don't know what it was, but it was certainly felt. Even in the water, there was somebody who lives on a boat right close to downtown, and they also felt it on their boat.
So they had vibration of their boat in the water?
Correct.
That means the water was vibrating.
Absolutely.
And what would make the water vibrate?
I'm not certain. It's strange. So many puzzling questions. We're not sure.
The next day, Saturday, April 14th, halfway across the country in Columbia, Missouri, the supervisor for the university's chemistry department, ChemStores, and his wife were alarmed by a tremendous crashing metallic boom at 7:30 p.m. Michael Dinsmore is 59 years old and has worked in the University of Missouri Chemistry Department for 20 years. He compares the sound to a railroad car slamming at full speed into a stone wall.
All of a sudden, we heard this tremendous explosion, a crash-like noise.
What was your wife's reaction?
Well, she jumped. She was real startled. And I've never, you know, we've been married 30 years, and in all the various storms and sounds that you hear, I've never had her say, you better go outside and see what that is. So I know she saw that as something really unique and also something that was disturbing to her. It was not thunder. I know what thunder is. Best way I can describe it is if you could imagine taking one of the really large railroad cars, the big metal ones, and if you slammed it at full speed into a stone wall, It was a very concussive sound with the metallic tone in it. There isn't even a railroad in Columbia, Missouri. The nearest railroad tracks is 5 or 7 miles away. The sound only lasted between 1 and 2 seconds. It was very brief, much more like an explosion type sound, very loud. And I went out to the front yard to see if I could deduce what it may have been. The sound was over. I didn't hear any emergency sirens like from the fire department or police department. And as I was standing there, I noticed across the street my neighbor and his wife came out. And the first thing he said to me was, "Did you hear that?" And I said, "Yeah, that's why I'm out here." And he goes, "Any idea what the world that could have been?" And I said, "No, it was so loud." And I said, "Well, do you think maybe it could have been a car wreck up here on the main road?" And he goes, "No, no, it's way too loud for that." I came back in, and over the next few days, I checked the local news stations, checked the local newspapers, in the hopes that there would be some kind of reference or an explanation, but nothing was ever printed. I really don't know what could account for it. I have never, ever heard anything like this before.
And George, you can tell from all of these voices now, from a professor to a meteorologist to a couple that are in pharmacy and physical training. There was a local law enforcement in central Ohio. There were many, many people in England. We're talking about a three-day period where what seems to be the similar loud metallic boom sound was heard. And even though the UK MOD tried to explain the initial huge boom sound heard over 5 counties in England as their 2 typhoon jets, there are others who are disagreeing with that. And you have to add, this is the very first time that there have been at least 2 eyewitnesses and an odd photograph to something that would be in the category of unidentified aerial craft over Bath, where this helicopter was, that the MOD said was giving off a very unusual emergency signal, and that's why they scrambled those jets. What in the world, on a whole northern hemisphere in a 72-hour period, could be making similar sounds in all of these disparate geographic areas? And then there's one more piece. A month ago, when I was on coast, the focus was on Clintonville, Wisconsin,
yeah.
And I did the interview with the city administrator, Lisa Coos. Well, that was around the second to third week in March, going toward the end. And then on April 1st, southeast of Montello and Clintonville, there was two booms, 45 minutes apart on Sunday, April 1st.
Right. They thought it might have been the earthquake, right, for a while?
No. This is in Baraboo.
Okay.
This is long after that tiny little earthquake that they tried politically to explain.
Yeah, it was 1.5 or something like that.
This was so important in Baraboo because a police officer was one of the witnesses to a bright flash of light. They had witnesses on both of the booms, 45 minutes apart, with flashes of light. Now, we are talking about a phenomena that hasn't stopped, and to me is one of the most puzzling I've ever encountered, and I hope that our listeners will get in touch with me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com if you have any more to contribute to this strange boom mystery.
Our next story with Linda Moulton Howe concerns you and your health. Stand by for that one. Hey, if you're a Coast Insider, this coming Monday, you'll have an opportunity to chat with Linda Moulton Howe during our monthly chat. So take advantage of it. It'll be this Monday coming up, 8 p.m. Pacific time, 11 p.m. Eastern time, chatting for the Coast Insiders with Linda Moulton Howe. We'll come back with more of her stories in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Linda, sounds like you're beginning to hone in on this tragedy with our honeybees.
Well, you know as well as anyone that I've been reporting about this since February of 2007, when beekeepers on the East Coast first were reporting 60 to 80% loss of their colonies and were completely panicked. What could be doing this? And it came to be known by February of 2007 as something called colony collapse disorder, which is the disappearance of honeybees in these large numbers. And it extended all over the United States, into Canada, England, and other European countries. And in my first February 2007 interview for Earth Files and for Coast to Coast AM about this huge honeybee colony loss, Pennsylvania beekeeper Dave Hackenberg warned then that he suspected nicotine-based pesticides. And since then, Italy, France, and Germany have restricted or banned nicotine-based insecticides. Scientific research continues to show that even the smallest amounts of nicotine toxins, such as imidacloprid and clothianidin, kill honeybees and other pollinators. And now in 2012, as one-third of American commercial honeybee colonies continue to die off every year, threatening the viability of almond and other food crop pollinations, the American acreage planted with clothianidin-coated seeds is the largest on record, approaching some 150, maybe 200 million acres this year. Meanwhile, over the past decade, the Environmental Protection Agency has ignored its own internal scientist warnings, first revealed in a November 2, 2010 leaked internal document to Colorado honey beekeeper Tom Theobald. That leaked EPA memo stated that the nicotine-based pesticide clothianidin manufactured by Bayer Corporation in Germany, quote, is highly toxic to honeybees, close quote. This is EPA's internal scientist. And then, violating its own regulations, EPA has repeatedly granted what are called unconditional registrations to Bayer Corporation to sell clothianidin in the United States without any accurate field research with genuine data concerning clothianidin safety. And finally, on March 21st, 2012, commercial beekeepers and environmental organizations backed by over a million citizens filed an emergency citizen petition to the EPA seeking suspension of registration for clothianidin. Ban this dangerous nicotine-based toxin, a million people said from the public. Signing the legal petition were the Center for Food Safety, International Center for Technical Assessment, Beyond Pesticides, and the Pesticide Action Network in North America, along with 25 honey beekeepers, including Pennsylvania's Dave Hackenberg. And at the end of my Earth Files report tonight about this legal petition are all the contact names, titles, phone numbers, emails, websites for all of you who are interested in trying to help with this devastating problem. Contact these people, see what you can do in your communities to help. Now, another co-petitioner in this legal petition to EPA is Jeff Anderson, owner of the California Minnesota Honey Farms, and he sort of summed up the whole situation so well. Quote, EPA has an obligation to protect pollinators from the threat of pesticides. The agency has failed to adequately regulate pesticides harmful to pollinators, despite scientific and on-the-ground evidence presented by academics and beekeepers, close quote. It's now a month later. EPA has acknowledged receipt of the legal petition, but so far has made no further comment. Recently, I asked Jay Feldman, executive director of Beyond Pesticides, and Tom Theobald, owner of the Niwot Honey Farm in Colorado, about whether this legal petition can stop EPAs using conditional registrations as a loophole to keep approving Bayer's clothianidin for sale in the United States. First, here is Jay Feldman, Beyond Pesticides from Washington, D.C.
The point of this petition is to demand that EPA exercise its emergency authority under our federal pesticide law because of the disappearance of about a third of our honeybees yearly now as a result of what we're pointing to as these systemic pesticides called neonicotinoids, allowed to be used even though EPA acknowledged that it did not have all the information necessary to make a clear determination of safety, and it turned around and accepted it as a supplemental study and didn't change the use pattern of this chemical. That's an abomination of the process.
Is it because corporations such as Monsanto wire the pockets of Congress with money? And that means the agencies such as EPA and FDA are also being wired with money by corporations that want all decisions to fall their way.
Yeah, I think the fact that we have vested interests with so much power, the vested interests being the chemical companies, one great example of the power of the chemical industry that's seen in this federal law is the provision we're struggling with here, which is something called conditional registration. Why would you allow an admitted toxic chemical on the market without having all your I's dotted and T's crossed, knowing that they can adversely impact human health and the environment?
And wasn't that revealed in that leaked document from inside the Environmental Protection Agency about a year ago, in which the scientists inside of EPA were saying that it was clear that clothianidin was killing honeybees?
Yes, that's exactly right. The agency itself, and this is what we're relying on as one of the exhibits in this petition, had identified a huge gap in information that was necessary to make a determination on the use of this chemical, clothianidin, and it didn't have that information according to the memo. And we've gone back and we've reviewed the studies, and it's clear that this study that the agency had accepted as valid was filled with irrelevant data for assessing the likely impact of this chemical on approximately 90 million U.S. acres of corn treated with clothianidin in the U.S.
It was the beekeepers in 2007, Dave Hackenberg in Pennsylvania said, Linda, I am trying to run away from these nicotine-based insecticides as fast as I can because I and other beekeepers, we are convinced it is these new nicotine-based pesticides that are killing our bees. How can we be 5 years later?
Because we live in a toxic soup which the chemical companies hide behind. Now, had EPA done its job, as it should have done at the onset of this request for registration by Bayer, it would have probably made a determination that there was something awful going on here that needed to be prevented.
Doesn't it boil down to nicotine-based pesticides need to be banned?
Yes. It goes back to the fact that we're unleashing technologies that we don't really study fully and understand in terms of the ramifications.
What would it take? How could nicotine-based pesticides be banned?
Well, it requires public involvement. The kind of coalition that's been put together around this type of petition says to the government that this is an issue of environmental protection. It's also an issue of economic health of the beekeeping industry.
What do you say, Jay, to honey beekeepers who are giving up now on struggling to raise weak, sick, and dying honeybees?
Yeah. Well, I think a good start is to get EPA to recognize that these systemic pesticides, as captured in this petition that was filed, that is an emergency. And we've got to get behind this petition as a means of removing this through the market. Beekeepers are between a rock and a hard place when it comes to the fact that they are providing pollination services in conventional agriculture. They're stuck with where agriculture is at this moment in time. So it really takes a coming together of the consumer community and the beekeeping community and the environmental community to say there is a better way, and we can all together make this transition toward organic production methods that are not reliant on these things. That's the bottom line. We have to stop using it. We only have two choices. We can stop using it by trying to force our regulatory agencies to ban these things, or we can stop using it if consumers refuse to buy crops grown with them.
What do you think realistically will be the very next step from here?
We've asked for action based on imminent hazard, which is an emergency provision in the federal pesticide law, and we would expect within 30 days we'd have a response to that. We need to see how seriously the agency takes this issue and decide from there what legal action we can take seeking injunctive relief against the agency. These are all complicated legal maneuverings that go on.
Meanwhile, Monsanto and Bayer are distributing the nicotine-based insecticides out in the world, and honeybees continue to die.
Right, exactly. We've become very lethargic and slow and bureaucratic, really crisis-oriented, and the crisis has to be staring us in the face.
The honeybee keepers say this is a crisis.
Right, and unfortunately, EPA has not yet been able to see it. And why that is hard to know. We're hoping that this petition helps to galvanize that awareness and give them the legal handles that they maybe couldn't see for themselves. That's what you do in a petition. You say, look, guys, you've got the authority to do this. Here it is. You know, it's in Section 6 of the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. It's in Section 7 of the Endangered Species Act. You have the legal authority to do this, do it and go for it. You're not doing what you're supposed to do. Wake up. There's some urgency here.
One of the longtime American honeybee keepers with a passion for raising honeybees is Tom Theobald, owner of the Niwot Honey Farm in Niwot, Colorado. Tom was appalled when he received a copy of the leaked November 2nd, 2010 EPA internal document that clearly stated, quote, "Clothianidin is highly toxic to honeybees," close quote. Tom thought that revelation would convince EPA to stop giving Bayer Corporation permission to sell clothianidin in the United States. But now, as 2012 goes forward with the largest acreage of seasonal crops in the United States on record planted with clothianidin, in spite of the legal petition and growing scientific evidence that clothianidin kills honeybees, Tom Theobald feels like giving up.
It's probably over for me. This will probably be my last year. I can't continue to pour money into the operation and rebuild it from the ashes every year and conduct a business. And I'm indicative of what is happening all across the country.
And if you beekeepers can't sustain keeping honeybees going, what happens in the United States?
Well, we've had over 200 million acres of farmland toxified and an untold number of acres in the urban and suburban landscape. I think we may very well be witnessing one of the greatest environmental disasters of our time. This is enormous and goes far beyond the honeybee. It may be too late for the beekeepers. Wherever these systemic pesticides have been introduced, we're seeing enormous consequences. Now, I've been doing this for 37 years. I had the smallest honey crop ever last year, and I've been a beekeeper long enough. The bees just weren't up to the task. These systemic pesticides have a number of modes of action, all the way from immediate death to lingering effects, which are cumulative and irreversible and kill the colony over time.
And isn't it true, Tom, that clothianidin and imidacloprid build up in soils, build up in the central nervous system of bees?
Yes, it appears from what we're seeing from the emerging science is that you would be hard-pressed to design a worse chemical. It's water-soluble, which means that it can be transported by the groundwater or the surface water, and it has almost immediate lethal effect. It can be expressed in the nectar and in the pollen. It can accumulate in the soil from successive plantings and can linger for decades. Very small amounts can have very significant effects.
And Tom, what do you think realistically happens if this legal petition against the EPA to ban clothianidin fails?
We're going to see a collapse of American beekeeping. I did a little survey just recently of Iowa. Iowa is the heartland of genetic modification and systemic seed coating. In 1993, Iowa had 70,000 managed colonies of bees. By 2008, it had 28,000. It has lost 66% of its managed colonies of bees. I think it's the corporations that need to be reined in, frankly. And there need to be some limits because they've taken control of everything. And a couple of years ago, a new term came into my vocabulary, and that is corporatism, the flip side of fascism. Fascism is the takeover of industry by government, and corporatism is the reverse. And the major corporations have taken control of just about everything. I think it may already be too late for the beekeepers. I hate to say that, but what if we stopped use of these chemicals immediately today, which is very unlikely. But if we stopped today, what would it mean? Well, the environment is so polluted that it's going to be hostile for decades to come.
He's right, Linda.
And George, the facts are that in some of the science research of going out into the soils and trying to determine what is the half-life of clothianidin and imidacloprid and these nicotine-based pesticides. They're talking now that in the soil, 18 to 20 years from now, it will still be toxic. If we stop using this today, it's still going to be layered in this toxic soup in the soils. This is really becoming one of those horrible dilemmas that we have now so poisoned the environment and the soils, and that this creature that we need so badly, the honeybee and the pollinators, are dying off because of these poisons, and that we have what appears to be a terrible problem now between what agencies in governments that are supposed to protect the environment and people, that the priorities have switched over to profits for corporations. And recently, behind Bayer Corporation, there is another big one in the United States, Monsanto, that is very highly involved in genetically modified crops with systemic pesticides in them. And they are running into the problems that the genetically modified plants with systemic pesticides are creating monster weeds. So they're trying to come up with even greater poisons.
Yeah. Stronger.
And it's killing the honeybees. There's no question about it. In the next half hour, we're going to hear from one of the leading entomologists in the United States about the work that he has done. And just to drive home how political and profit greed motivated the problem has become, Monsanto's genetically modified corn was recently banned in Poland, like it has been also in Italy and France. Well, what did Monsanto do in September of 2011, a few months ago? They bought what was then a very respected research company called B-Logix. Everybody in the industry I've talked to said, this is so clearly, transparently, politically motivated by Monsanto.
It's a conflict of interest.
Completely. And B-Logix is in what is called good collaboration with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, but here's another problem. The USDA acts as if it is a close collaborator, an ally of Monsanto, not the honeybees and the general public. And I urge everyone listening tonight to go to earthfiles.com, open up this report about the legal petition, and scroll down to the end, where I have all the contacts, the names, the phone numbers, email.
Well, you've got it all, Linda, and the story continues when we come right back.